Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 22nd of November. In their joint statement that was issued yesterday before the midnight deadline, Democratic and Republican leaders of the Super Committee panel, the special congressional committee that was put together to curb the national debt, made this statement. They said that they were deeply disappointed by their inability to reach agreement, and they hope for progress in the months ahead. Despite our inability to bridge the committee's significant differences, we end this process united in our belief that the nation's fiscal crisis must be addressed and that we cannot leave it for the next generation to solve. They said that they are hopeful that Congress can build on the committee's work and can find a way to tackle the issue in a way that works for the American people and also for our economy. Well, it means a lot to taxes and to the deficit. There are concerns that it could put the country back in recession by raising taxes on almost everyone while reducing government spending on almost everything. We have two guests with us to talk about the collapse of this committee and what's ahead. Lizzie O'Leary is joining us at the top of the show, Washington, D.C.-based correspondent for Bloomberg Television, covering politics and economic policy from the White House, Treasury Department, and Capitol Hill. She also serves as a regular panelist on Political Capital with Al Hunt. She has reported extensively on the global credit crisis, the housing market, the government's financial rescue package, as well as the Gulf Coast oil spill disaster. Later this hour, Professor Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. I would imagine we'll have more than a few phone calls on this issue. We've been talking about the deficit and taxes for a long time. Well, here we are, gridlock once again. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Lizzie O'Leary, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, here we are, gridlock once again. Right, Lizzie?
Yeah, this is gridlock, and the way it was originally designed, this is gridlock with some relatively severe consequences in terms of government spending and, as you pointed out, potential effects on the economy as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the process. How long have these people been meeting, and you've been following it? Have there been any indications that they may have been close to a breakthrough?
Well, there were a couple of plans that went back and forth. They've been meeting since September, and I think, you know, if you try to cast off a little bit of cynicism, there have been moments when the different sides put forth different plans. Look, we're in a moment where the Democrats blame Republicans, the Republicans blame Democrats, and there is a lot of blame to go around. It is worth reminding listeners that there are serious philosophical differences among the parties about how to achieve deficit reduction. You know, a lot of Republicans said, we simply will not raise taxes. Their stance on that seemed to be a little harder than the Democratic stance not to cut entitlements, because they were willing to make some entitlement cuts. And I guess I would say there were a couple of moments when the super committee members kick the staff out of the room, and that in translating Congress is generally a sign that they were actually negotiating, but it's been a while since one of those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so disappointing to the American people. If the super committee can't do it, Congress couldn't do it, so they gave it to the super committee. Now they can't do it, so what's going to happen?
Well, if they actually stick by this plan, and that's a very big if, we will see automatic cuts go into place in 2013. They rather cleverly built themselves a little more than a year of buffer, and it is true that a law Congress passes, they can undo. So there is a movement afoot to try to undo some of those automatic cuts that by the way the law was written, would be equally balanced between defense spending and non-defense spending.
So how would that be undone?
It would be undone by having to pass another law. The president said yesterday evening that he would veto any attempt to do that. And I should point out, one of the things that I looked at, you know, obviously we're looking at whether or not there would be another potential credit downgrade of the United States. Mm. I called up S&P's head of sovereign debt a while ago, and he said, look, if they don't reach an agreement, that doesn't have huge deficit consequences because they still now automatically go into cuts. But if they weaken the bill, if they try to undo those automatic cuts, that might have what they say in agency speak, downward pressure on the rating.
Mm-hmm. The New York Times today talks about the fact that what is crucial here, the thing that keeps this from moving forward at all, is the Republicans' refusal to raise taxes on the rich. Is that too simple?
I don't think it's too simple. I think that is a part of what's going on here. There is a refusal to raise taxes on the rich, and there is a refusal to raise taxes all around. The highest they were going to go, they being the Republicans on the committee, was a top tax rate of about 28%. Democrats wanted to push it to 25%. They wanted to see the repeal of the Bush tax cuts here. And remember, that was sort of twinned into all of this. The way things would work now is that the Bush tax cuts would be repealed.
And that means we would all see our taxes go up by how much, and it would be in January?
It means we would all see our taxes go up. It sort of depends on your tax rate. The other thing that's going on here is the potential undoing of a payroll tax cut, which probably has more of an effect for the vast majority of working people. They would see their taxes go up about $900.
Mm-hmm. And what about the concerns of going into another recession? We hear a little bit about that. Does that seem likely?
We're still growing. You know, we got some GDP figures today, so we're growing at about 2%. We should remind people that a recession is negative growth, or I guess we should say stagnating. I think, to be frank, there is probably a bigger risk from Europe right now in terms of pushing us into another recession than even the super committee, because we are still growing, even though the growth is weak. People are still buying our bonds. They want to do that. But the risks that Europe really blows up, that, given the interconnectedness of the financial system, is probably even more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Lizzie, what has happened in Washington? It seems to me as though part of the way that you govern successfully is you sit down, this super committee, around a table, and you may not like something that I've proposed, and I might not like something that you've proposed, but for the good of advancing an important piece of legislation, we're going to give a little. Why is there no giving?
In part because, think about it this way, a committee's job, any committee, whether it's the super committee or the agriculture committee or the appropriations committee, is to go ahead and do its work its will, do its processes, pass laws. The congressional leadership's job is to get reelected and make sure that their members get reelected. And those two things in this instance were fundamentally at loggerheads because there was no political gain. Even if there was a governing gain that the members saw to that art of compromise, they saw that, for example, when you see the 87 House freshmen who came in on the Republican side backed by the Tea Party, one of the things that brought them there was really sticking to an ideological stance, was not negotiating and not compromising. So the political benefit with the base in some ways seemed to outweigh what common sense would tell you is that Americans want compromise. They
right.
want, you know, right. some type of reaching across the aisle.
And what in the world is going to get us off that? How are we going to look at the common good?
Well, I think that probably involves going back to asking what the fundamental question is here. You know, this is a deficit cutting committee, and you can look at it economically and say, well, wait a minute, probably the biggest risks to the U.S. economy right now are not our deficit and debt, but the fact that we have a lot of unemployed people and we're not growing very fast. But if you make the priority deficit reduction, then people sort of get swirled up in that. So I think there is a question about really naming what the priority is, because at this point, the two parties have very different priorities.
Right. Lizzie O'Leary is our guest for the first part of the show. We'll take a couple of phone calls for her. She's Washington, D.C.-based correspondent for Bloomberg Television. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and we start our calls with Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, dear. Good morning. I thought it was interesting, other than the fact that I think generally the makeup of Congress would like that fella who's 82 years old, who's been in Congress since 1970, other than the fact that we have the wrong types of people generally in Congress, consistent with the times that we're in, I thought that Ari Fleischer last night on CNN was really quite insightful, and Paul Begala and Gergen both agreed with him. He basically said, you know, the elephant in the room here, my quote, is Barack Obama and a lack of presidential leadership. And he pointed the fact that Clinton administration and the Bush administration, not necessarily on the gravity that we're dealing with here, but they were able to essentially bring Congress, because as Fleischer pointed out, he said Congress by itself needs to have some form of leadership in these type of situations. And they were able to get things done to a greater or lesser extent with these divided Congresses. He pointed out that here he said this has to fall clearly on a lack of leadership on the part of Barack Obama. And for the first time since I've seen it, Gergen agreed with him, and Begala just simply sat there silent. So I think that's essentially the bottom line that we're dealing with here, and I'd be interested to hear what you're...
Okay. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for the call. Lizzie?
Well, I think that is an argument that you can make in a valid way, but I think one of the things that the White House was thinking in terms of their strategy here, and certainly your caller takes issue with it, and I think a lot of people here in Washington take issue with it, was the question of whether by getting involved in this, the White House would taint it, that there is so much opposition to the president among Republicans in Congress that he might have actually made the process even worse. Had you seen a more aggressive White House in this? You know, I think it's always worth pointing out that the hand of the White House is stronger than you see it publicly. Privately, it always is. But in this scenario, I think they were very, very careful because they felt like they might hurt the process even more. We'll never know. We'll never know whether a stronger outreach by the president would have changed the outcome here, but I think it would have made the political rhetoric much more heated and probably even more toxic, if that's possible.
Yeah, can it possibly be more toxic? What happens from here, Lizzie?
Well, what happens from here is this series of automatic cuts that are supposed to go into place in January of 2013, and that's really important to note. And they would, you know, take a big across-the-board whack. We would see a whack in defense spending and a whack in domestic spending. I think it's probably worth pointing out that if you're focusing on deficits, in the long run, defense spending is a big driver, but the biggest driver of our deficits is health care. It's health care costs, and it's specifically Medicare, much more so than Social Security or Medicaid or other programs. Medicare is the biggie, and if you want to focus on deficits, you know, a lot of the things Congress has been and the White House have been fighting over is domestic discretionary spending. That's only 12% of the federal budget overall. So it's kind of a lot of fighting over a very small slice of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Lizzie, thank you very much for your reporting and for being with us.
Thank you.
Lizzie O'Leary, Washington, D.C.-based correspondent for Bloomberg Television. We're continuing our conversation on the super committee not living up to its name because of irreconcilable differences, mostly, according to press reports, over tax increases for the wealthy among us. Joining us momentarily, Professor Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, senior fellow Roosevelt Institute. Our phone number, we'd like to hear from many of you this hour. We've talked about these issues before. Were you hopeful that the super committee would be able to break through this excessive partisanship in Congress and come up with some plan so that everybody's taxes don't go up in January, which seems likely, and programs that are precious to you are not on the chopping block? It seems as though they just are not able to do their jobs for whatever reasons, and we'll try to find out more about what those reasons are as we continue. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, our number two of our program, we've had this guy on before. He's a terrific guest, and he's done this extraordinarily interesting big idea all over the country. Christopher Phillips started Socrates Cafes some months ago. He's now author of Constitution Cafe, Jefferson's Brew for a True Revolution. Christopher is a scholar of Thomas Jefferson, and he thinks that Jefferson had a belief that we ought to look at the Constitution and change it. It ought to be a true democracy where we're all writing the document that guides us. And we ought to do that about every 20 years. So we're over 200 years overdue for this. And if we were to change parts of the Constitution, if we were to examine it, what would we have to say about it? So he's done this. He's gone all over the country with many, many groups, and they sit down and they talk about the Constitution. He will be with us to talk about Constitution Cafe, and that's coming up the second hour of our program. This hour, we are looking at the collapse of the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, the partisan gridlock and complete dysfunction in Washington, the prospect of $1.2 trillion in automatic reductions to government agency budgets in January of 2013, the prospect of an increase in our taxes this January. We're trying to find our guest for the next part of the program. So in the meantime, we have a ton of phone calls. We'll just listen to your thoughts about the collapse of the super committee. Let's go to Anna in Madison. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Thanks for my call.
Sure.
You know, I had the privilege of twice seeing a wonderful play put on in Madison called The Lamentable Tragedy of Scott Walker. Absolutely brilliant. And really dealt with, you know, how even well-meaning people who refuse to compromise are ultimately idiots. And it's, I mean, I guess when your next guest comes on, I hope, I pray for some kind of breath of hope. And it's not, what I've been saying to some of my friends is, what I really want to see is the rebirth of moderate Republicanism. The rebirth of, and probably moderate Democrats too, because it seems that it was possible to compromise in the past, and I feel completely hopeless the way things are now.
And what do you think, Anna, is going to be able to move us toward more moderation, toward compromise? How do we accomplish that? It's our government. I mean, it's up to us in some way, isn't it?
You know, and I think, quite honestly, you know, they're in, obviously in Wisconsin, we're working on a recall. Some members, you know, some people in Wisconsin are working on recall. And one of the people who's been talked about to run for governor is a very young guy. And I think that actually that's probably going to be our best hope, is that the next generation is looking at us going, oh, my word, this is not how... this is not what democracy looks like. I can't think of any other hopeful thing to say.
All right, Anna, thank you very much
thank
for the call.
So much.
We just can't find our guest, but we were going to listen to a lot of your thoughts about what happened with this super committee, saying that they're sorry. I mean, it really is incredible when you think about it. This super committee, the people on the committee, you would think are more likely to be able to listen to each other and compromise. Sorry, we just couldn't reach an agreement. you know, better luck next time. It's really important. Go to it, everybody else. We couldn't do it. What do you think of that? We go to Davey in McKinley Park, Illinois. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. What I'd like to say is what we should do is just, if they eliminated all of their expense accounts, starting from the president down to the lowliest little janitor, and we'll start from there, and, you know, maybe they could take a cut in their pay like everybody else had to, you know, take some of their 401ks away like, you know, we had to give up to pay for our bills because, you know, everybody lost their jobs. That might be a start.
Mm-hmm. Well, what our previous guest said is interesting in that people aren't hearing the American people here. There's really a disconnect between how people are hurting in this country and what they want Congress to do and what Congress is not doing. Nothing is happening. I mean, the problems aren't being addressed. Nothing's going on.
Yeah, it's just the political bickering back and forth.
Yeah. Well, I think people are saying enough. You know, do something. I may not like all that you do, but do your job.
Exactly. And then, you know, when they go into these jobs, they start at high salaries. Like, when we start a job, we have to start at the bottom and work our way up. But they go in and get full salaries, full pensions, everything.
Thanks, Davey, for your call. Jeff in Plain, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I have a comment trying to bridge your two guests today. First of all, if we had a six-year presidential term with no ability to be reelected and we had maybe something similar in Congress, maybe all this posturing over elections would go away and people would do the right thing. But my question really is, what authority does the president have, executive order-wise, if the president wants to or has the courage to do that, to solve the problem that the super committee could not solve? And I'd like you to ask your next guest that. I was hoping you'd be on by now to say, what presidential authority is there?
Okay, that's a good question. I hope we find the next guest to ask that question. All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question because he has used executive orders in the past couple of months. I don't know if it's possible over something this large. Let's go to Dave in Ellison Bay. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to agree with the previous caller about the idea of term limits, especially from the standpoint that it seems pretty clear that Republicans and Democrats are essentially beholden to some special interest group, one or another. But anyway, my comment primarily, Kathleen, was that I believe that the real problem is not a lack of compromise now. It's that they've been compromising for so long and giving away, thinking of different ways to give away money that we really don't have, which has created the national debt. And now what they're grappling with is the fact that there's no more money. I mean, people are watching more closely than ever before. Most people are alarmed by the level of national debt that there is, and they're saying, you know, there is no more money to give away to whatever special interest group these two different partisan groups are pandering to. And, you know, compromise at this point is, frankly, because everybody is watching and they really can't agree on who to give the money to when there is really no money to give away.
Would you be philosophically opposed, Dave, to raising taxes on those who are wealthy?
Well, Kathleen, as I understand it, and obviously there's a lot of disagreement about this, I'm not wealthy, but from what I've read, the wealthy are already paying a large percentage of the taxes. And even if you took all of the wealth of the wealthy, not just taxing them incrementally, but if you took all of their wealth, it wouldn't even come close to solving the national debt crisis. Yeah. So, you know, the notion of taxing one person more to give the money to someone else, that's partly what's got us into the problem now.
But
the whole recall thing in Wisconsin, by and large, is about a group of people who are all of a sudden dealing with the reality that the current administration, which, frankly, I don't agree with their tactics altogether, but there's a huge special interest that realizes that all of a sudden government is not going to give them what they want, that government first had to take from someone else. So, you know, we're at a crisis, and it really does have to do with the Constitution and the limit of government, and it is an ideological battle that has to do with basically the force of government to take money from one group and give it to another.
But we've always done that.
Well, that explains to some degree why we have a multi-trillion-dollar national debt, and frankly, $15 trillion is probably not even close to what the real debt is. Like your previous guest said, Medicare and Social Security together, unfunded liabilities, they dwarf the $15 trillion, you know, deficit figure that people are talking about. And I'm sure you could have people on your program that explain that in very simple terms. So anyway, thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks very much for the call. We can't find our guest. We're trying to locate another one, but we certainly have plenty of your response to the joint statement, Democratic and Republican leaders of the supercommittee saying they were deeply disappointed by their inability to reach agreement and hope for progress in the months ahead. They end the process united in the belief that the nation's fiscal crisis must be addressed and that we cannot leave it for the next generation to solve. Mark in Waukesha, hi.
Hi, how you doing, Kathleen?
Well, I'm all right, Mark.
I love
how
your show.
Thank you.
Regarding this assumption that, you know, cutting taxes for people who earn over $250,000 a year stifles job growth, from what I've read, that there's no scientific evidence that that's true. When Reagan cut taxes to people earning over 250K a year, it didn't stimulate job growth at all. In fact, we had another recession. That's my comment. And regarding the super committee, the only thing I can say there is a horse designed by committee is a donkey. I mean, I don't know what they were expecting in the super committee, but I personally just think it was set up to fail from the beginning.
Because why?
Well, you have a ideological differences, a number of people thrown into a room who are at opposite ends of the equator, and they're not going to agree on anything no matter what. You got Party people in with staunch Democrats who are just not going to meet in the middle. It's a system set up, like I said. You're going to, even if they could come up with something, it's a horse designed by committee is going to be a donkey. In other words, we're going to have something that nobody wants.
Okay. All right, Mark. Thank you very much. Thanks
Thank
for the call.
You.
Stay in the line, everybody. We'll be with you. We have found our guest, Professor Thomas Ferguson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Senior Fellow in the Roosevelt Institute, and we are talking about the super committee just saying they couldn't reach agreement, and they're sorry, and they still think it's important, but somebody needs to address this. Let's not leave it to the next generation to solve. So the question is, who's going to address this and what are the ramifications of their not being able to sit down and deal with this issue? Professor Thomas Ferguson, hello.
Hi there.
Did you expect more from this super committee or did you say, oh, yeah?
I thought, in all honesty, that they would come in with a minimal deal, mostly based on accounting gimmicks that would reach the sort of bare minimum, which would have been $15 trillion over 10 years, and you know, the surprise to me was, well, they couldn't even do it with gimmicks. That was the remarkable thing to me.
Why couldn't they?
Well, it looks to me, we don't know quite all the facts, and I'm a little cautious based on press accounts, which have been, you know, repeatedly one-sided or wrong in the past. But it looks to me like there really was, the Republicans really did dig in on the no new taxes issue. And they were just, you know, back in the summer when the president was actively involved in this, at one point the Democratic leadership offered the deal with the Republicans that boiled down to effectively $9 in cuts for every $1 in tax rises, and they wouldn't take that. This time it never got more than about, looks like, $2 in cuts for each $1 in a tax rise, and evidently the Republicans were still just, I mean, they were completely unwilling to move. Now, the curiosity here is that when you look at the polls, everybody's polls gives you the same result, which is that about two-thirds of the population
right.
want taxes
yes.
raised on the rich, even a majority of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
and it didn't happen. Neither party was in the, you know, working very hard on that. And when you look at those polls a little more closely, you also discover that by like 4-to-1 majorities, nobody wants cuts in Social Security, and they don't want them in Medicare. And yet, you know, the Democrats were out there offering cut all the time. And when the Republicans would say that's not enough, they'd come back with some more. Eventually, they just, it seems like they couldn't reach cuts big enough, and the Republicans were just dug in on the tax issue.
Well, if what you say is true, and it appears to be true, that people do think that those among us who are wealthy should pay more, what other force was at the table here? Because it just makes common sense that if everybody agrees that that's what has to happen to make things better and not leave it to the next generation, then we do it.
Well, yes, except for the fact that, you know, political money, I mean, I'm sorry to slip into what's a almost, it's hard not to use a political vocabulary here, though I'd rather, you know, I'm not a big fan of either political party, but frankly, you know, the 1% have most of the money, and they have nearly all of the political money. I mean, there's effectively no really significant small contributions in the American political system. They don't drive anything at any point, and I have a fair number of colleagues in political science who've written the contrary. When you look at their numbers, it's obviously way, way off. And this is a big money-dominated political system. That's the story, and it has tended, you know, I've done some work on Congress. The last 20 years in particular have tended to concentrate more and more resources in the hands of the leadership, which then bargains with national interest groups, and particularly with big ticket investors. And so you get a kind of iron control on the Congress, and you get many more folks reluctant to take a chance on crossing the leadership. I mean, I think it really comes down to that. It's a kind of, you will forgive the plain English, a kind of godfather logic dominates the U.S. Congress with the big bosses in touch with big money.
This is depressing. Who are those powerful? Who are the most powerful national interest groups?
Well, I think, look, the largest companies and the richest individual Americans, who many of whom have net worth that's bigger than many of the companies. They're the folks, look, I've been doing this for 25 years. They're the folks I analyze in my samples, you know, presidential election year after presidential election year. I mean, that, and the huge numbers of these folks, a few of these folks are willing to tolerate. You get the occasional Warren Buffett a few people emulating him. You don't find very many, and nobody wants to see really substantial tax rises. I mean, you know, you get the differences here amount to, well, shall we, you know, raise taxes by 5% on them or nothing at all. And you know, it's like you've got two planets out there that were supposed to be revolving around the central sun of the population, and instead they've gone off on their own responding to other gravitational pulls. That's, you got an out-of-control political system right now.
And yet, my understanding is that come January, because of all of this, we're all going to see our taxes go up. So
yeah.
Who does that help? That's not good.
Right. This begins to get really interesting. I mean, I'm loath to sort of speculate, but it is, you know, Mitch McConnell has said repeatedly that his biggest goal in life was to defeat President Obama. There's no doubt at all, if in the middle of a great recession you start raising taxes, and specifically you're going to raise Social Security taxes, they go back up to the old rate, then you're likely to, I mean, that's going to pull down economic growth in the short run. That's a powerful factor, I think, working for the Republicans. I mean, people think this election is going to be close. I think this election is going to be very strange, I notice, again, that third parties are at work getting on the ballot, and I frankly think you're going to see a third-party candidacy at some point there. And so I think a lot of calculations that people are conventional calculations that people are making about the upcoming year are likely to be dashed by a lot of surprises. But there's no doubt at all that, you know, the president clearly thinks that by staying back from these negotiations, he's helping himself. Otherwise, he'd have been more involved. You know, I have to say, I think that the lack of leadership there is going to come back to haunt them, even if, in fact, as I expect to happen, the polls will show that most people will blame Republicans more than Democrats. And, you know, we're actually sliding into a situation where you're beginning to get the population deeply skeptical about the basic legitimacy of democratic institutions. I mean, this is becoming a serious problem. And it's, I mean, you can see this in the renewed attacks. I was on NPR a few days ago where we were doing a discussion of congressional insider trading, and there's a lot of that. It's a serious problem. But this stuff is now coming as much from the right as from the left. And, you know, my reading of this is you are preparing the way for a kind of feeling that, well, you need technocratic regimes, just like you have, you know, former bank executives leading Italy and Greece right now. And you know, that type of technocratic stuff, I think you'll see more of, with the pressures for it also in the U.S.
And just before we go back to phone calls, this third party from the left, from the right, from the middle,
from the right.
Okay.
Nobody, I mean, left parties don't have the money to mount nationwide campaigns to get on the ballot. I mean, the what do they call that thing? Americans Elect or something like that. Peter Ackerman and company running it. This is from the right. Many of these folks have a history of attacks on Social Security and other programs.
Mona in Iron River, Wisconsin, our next caller. Hi, Mona.
It's Lona.
Oh, Lona. Hi, Lona.
With an L. Anyway, my comment today is that I truly feel that democracy is supposed to be a rule by compromise. And since the Republicans have signed this oath that is, no matter what they think, being held over their head by money, that the Republicans should get together and en masse sign a negation of this oath and get out from under that. Because if you are working for the people, then you are not going to eliminate any options for taking care of the people.
What oath are you referring to, Lona?
I am referring to the oath that they will, under no circumstances, raise any taxes.
Okay.
Which is a farce.
All right. Professor?
Well, am I supposed to disagree with this?
I mean, do whatever you want.
Yeah, I would say, look, you don't necessarily have to compromise when you got 80% or more of the population agreeing on the line. I think at that point, unless they're really bumping up against the constitutional prohibition, which none of this stuff is, they should just get to, you know, put the public policies through. But I take the lady's point that you'd like folks to compromise. And, yes, that is... on the tax issue now, we're in a pathological state. I mean, it has indeed become crazy.
Thanks for the call. Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Kudos to your guest and two phone-ins back. But the gentleman who objects to taxation, period, as being unconstitutional, is unaware that the extremely rich have very little economic utility. It's less than that those of us who have to pay the rent check at the end of the month. And one of the ways that you put their wealth to work is tax, make it either work in a productive investment or tax it away. That's how you mobilize large amounts of capital. So taxes are good. And the second point that I would like to make is that the United States does not have a short-term deficit problem. It has relatively tractable revenue problem. And if the Bush tax cuts were put back in place, two-thirds of the deficit would disappear. It's not that Barack Obama or the Democrats went mad spending or that we've been living above our means. It's we've been putting things on credit, and that is a Republican policy. So tax the rich to mobilize capital and put the tax cuts back.
back. That's all that we need to do in the short term, and then look after Medicare. So thank you again.
Thank you, Frank. Professor Ferguson.
Well, all right, I might quarrel with some details of that, but the overall thrust is, I think, pretty right. That is to say, the deficit's not a huge and intractable problem in the short run. I mean, I'd probably add a few details on, I think you're going to have to restrain health care, but you do that not by health care rates of increase, but you do that not by cutting off people from care, but by doing the obvious things that you could bring costs down. I mean, you could just have the government bargain down prices with the pharmaceutical industry. You could shift from fee for service, where you sort of multiply procedures and techniques and get paid and paid, and go instead to a kind of lump sum payment to keep people healthy, sort of like the Veterans Administration, where that seems to work very well, or force people to get one billing and information system, so that you don't have to have zillions of people faxing back and forth all the time. It's like just clouds of faxes accompany our current medical system. You need competition in insurance, which was the fight over the public option, et cetera. You know, I'd add, but, you know, basically that gentleman's got it right. I would not myself raise taxes on the whole population. That is to say, I'd let the Bush tax cuts for people making under about a million stay in. I don't see any coming there. I mean, after all, they're the folks who are getting stuck with the bills for bank bailouts and things like that. And so I think partly on equity and partly on, I would just not do. But I don't quarrel with his basic assessment. Yeah, the hysteria over the deficit is way overblown. It's not the fundamental problem. Fundamental problem is unemployment. That's what the government needs to be addressing urgently, you know, and nobody in either the White House or Congress is now even talking about that problem.
Isn't that incredible? With the rates so high and people so obviously concerned, my goodness, they're demonstrating all over the country.
Yep. No, look, you're now approaching levels of youth unemployment in the U.S. where you were with Egypt just before the spring demonstration started. I mean, that's probably what it's going to take in the U.S. to move these guys.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the super committee failing to reach any kind of agreement, saying they remain hopeful that Congress, can build on the committee's work and can find a way to tackle this issue in a way that works for the American people and for our economy. Do you have the same kind of hope? Where is the hope? Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our guest this part of the show is Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, and we'll be returning to you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our show, we're going to take on the Constitution. Our guest is Christopher Phillips and his latest book. He's the guy who did this. We interviewed him years ago when he started these Socrates cafes all over the country. There are now 500 of them all over the world. And the latest one looks at the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson had a radical proposal that we ought to revisit the Constitution every 20 years and change those things that need to be changed. We need to keep perfecting the Constitution. Constitution Cafe is a space in which aspiring Americans grapple with how they would sculpt the U.S. Constitution if they could start from scratch. And indeed, there are groups doing this all over the country. So Christopher is with us, hour number two. Two more of your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Bill in Madison, hello.
Well, I have two basic comments. One, I don't think the Republicans have any political incentive to compromise, because they figure that they can just wait it out until 2013, where they will have, they're confident that they're going to have full control of both Senate and House, as well as the White House. I think they feel pretty confident that they're going to have do a clean sweep, and that they'll do to the United States what Walker and his crew have done to Wisconsin. And so I don't see, I saw the whole super committee thing as doomed from the get-go. Now, on a larger scale. I believe that we're reaching a point where people are starting to, your guest has already mentioned it, that people are starting to question the legitimacy of the entire system, about, you know, the institutions themselves are being questioned. And I personally believe that that's what it's going to take. We're going to have a situation where you've heard the old saying, that which is unsustainable won't be sustained. Well, this is unsustainable, and eventually what's going to happen is it's going to take, you know, I hate to say this, but it's going to take a violent insurrection. I mean, you're going to see violence like you saw in Egypt.
You really think we're going to go that far, Professor Ferguson?
Well, you know, what you actually saw in Egypt, except for some military crackdowns, was exceedingly nonviolent protest, and roughly the same in Tunisia. And, you know, in that sense, it's not at all obvious to me that one has a problem here with violence. I mean, you can see how even just a bunch of folks camping out in parks changed the whole discussion in the United States for several months. I mean, I think people need to, unfortunately, come out into the streets. You're past the point of just expecting your elected representatives to do their duty. They plainly will not do this.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I don't want to be Pollyanna, but, you know, frankly, Occupy Wall Street did very well, and the obvious nonviolence of it. You know, all the famous videos you see are of, you know, I'm sorry to say, somebody in authority pepper spraying or beating people, or sometimes even beating veterans. It's the violence has, you know, that was not coming from the demonstrators thus far in the United States. It's been coming from the authorities.
Bill talked about the Republicans thinking they may have a clean sweep in next year's elections. Do you think that's a possibility?
Sure. Obviously, that's a possibility. The Senate elections are set up so that there's so many more Democrats running, they're at risk. In the House, you know, it's a little tougher to call, but I'd guess the majority is so big that Republicans probably hold it. The presidency, I'm a little skeptical of the standard scenarios. I think it's pretty clear that the population is very disaffected. And if you watch closely, you can see third-party organization going on. Now, these are all third parties really coming from the right, although they tried to pretend they're coming from the center. The people organizing these things like Americans Elect, they have a history of opposition to Social Security and things like that. But I think you may well see a third-party entry, because these folks are getting themselves on the ballot. They're on the ballot basically in every state they can legally get on now for the next year's election, and they, you know, the rest of them require them to operate in the election year, which it looks to me like they're going to do. I mean, I think this is going to be an interesting and somewhat scary and bumpy ride next year. It's not obvious to me how this comes out.
Huh. John in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention for your listeners that there was an interesting article in Forbes magazine this week, and it discussed how 0.1, not 1%, but 0.1% of the population of the U.S. collects more than 50% of all capital gains in a given year, and I thought that was pretty interesting. But I also had two suggestions for alternative taxes. If you look at the Defense Department, like a homeowner's insurance, it protects your assets. I would suggest that they move the Defense Department over to an asset tax, and you collect the assets, or you look up and assess the assets of all the corporations and people, and if somebody has 12 houses, the Defense Department's protecting more for that person than the person who doesn't have a home, so they should do it on an asset tax. The other thing I would suggest is if you want to reduce the volatility in the stock market, one thing they could do is put a 0.1% tax on shares traded. If you look 20 years, or if you look today, there's about 6 billion shares that are traded in the New York Stock Exchange every day, and about 10 billion in the NASDAQ. And Wall Street has cost taxpayers quite a bit of money, so that would be a way to collect it, and it would be insignificant because the cost of trading has dropped from $100 on $1,000 trading from 20 years ago down to less than $10. So you put a tax on trading, it would be insignificant. Nobody'd notice it.
Professor Ferguson.
Well, I actually sort of like the spirit of both those proposals. I think the financial transactions tax is way overdue. Yeah, that's partly because, exactly as the gentleman suggested, we are bailing out these institutions. They need to start paying their way. We have to get off this heads they win, tails we lose situation. But beyond that, anybody's argument about free markets doesn't, none of them reach a case where you are doing high frequency trading and you're doing in nanoseconds, making offers, withdrawing them, then resubstituting new ones. That's the complete destruction of a market. It's not an actual market. There aren't public prices that anybody can move to. That stuff needs to be just not regulated. It needs to be stopped dead in its tracks with the financial transactions tax. I think it's a very good idea. And, you know, one of the crazy aspects of the current world is that Treasury Secretary Geithner, with the support of the president, is out there trying to block the imposition of such a tax in Europe right now, even as we are talking.
Hmm.
Then on the defense case,
we have about 10 seconds.
Okay. You know, it certainly is the case. You've got to deal with the fact that you have broad interests all over the world that we pay for their support. And they oppose tax increases in the government. This is a little crazy. Something's got to give.
Professor Ferguson, I'd like to check in with you again in a couple months.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Professor Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Christy Pease for on-air production. And thanks for going along with the flow, everybody, and for your calls.